Sometimes, some Sabbaths, I stand with you and I wonder if I have enough to say. I think it's something a lot of preachers think about. Do I have enough to say today? Sometimes I wonder, is it enough for any one particular Sabbath? Is it enough of a new idea or an intriguing twist on an old idea? Is it enough new for today's troubled world? Is it enough new that's gospel? Is it enough new that's Adventist? Is it enough new that it made it worth you coming to church today, or that it made it worth you coming to this church today? Sometimes I wonder if I have enough to say when we open the word together. Hear a word from the Lord, Psalm 145, verse 8. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and rich in love. Is this enough for today? Is one verse from the Bible enough for today? John Calvin says of this particular verse 8, buried in Psalm 145, this is as clear a description of God as we'll find anywhere. This one verse is, in fact, the reason for the other 20 verses. This one verse is the reason for the other 149 psalms. This one verse is the reason there's a story. It's this one verse, as Genesis 1 and 2, and this one verse carries us all the way to the end, to the book of Revelation. The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love. It is this love that will wipe every tear at the end of our story. This one verse, is it enough? It's a question today, this one verse. Notice that it's really a description of God's actions. It's a verb definition of God, the way God moves. This is how we'll know the divine is on the move, because we'll note graciousness and compassionate. It's a verb definition. And the psalmist will repeat this definition again. It will be repeated many times in the Bible. In fact, this is what we hear at the base of Sinai when God tells directly to Moses, God self-reveals in God's own words. God says to Moses almost these very same words, Exodus 34, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God is slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. And this very description will be repeated now. It'll be this compassionate, loving mercy, this mercy and loyal love which will carry Joseph as he goes off to Egypt and he survives in Potiphar's establishment. It'll be this very love that chases Jonah when Jonah avoids the call from God. It will be this loyal love that protects God's people when they go off to Babylon. It's the loyal love of God that sustains them. It's the same loyal love Jesus will put on display when he says, love your enemies, pray for those who hate you, let the sinless one cast the first stone. It's God's loyal love on display when Jesus moves. So the universe runs on this loyal love of God. You see, the problem is not that this is not enough. The problem is that this is everything and we miss it. This is everything. And when we're confused about who God is, we're confused about how we're to be and how we're to be in God's world. Oh, this one verse is not only enough, it's everything. The problem is when we're confused about it. In Rabbi Harold Kushner's latest book, Nine Essential Things I've Learned About Life. His latest book, Nine Essential Things. You know this author. Many of you purchased his book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. In his newest book, he identifies nine big ideas, now closer to the end of his life, nine ideas that are settling with him. Here's one of Rabbi Kushner's nine ideas. He suggests that maybe we have a problem, and it begins when we ask children to draw God. When we put crayons in their hand, as soon as children can sit still, and we say, draw us a picture of God. And when the children draw a picture of God, God appears, well, you know what the pictures look like. You draw them too. Your grandchildren drew them. Your children drew them. God is an old man with gray hair. God is a tall man with a big beard. God is human for sure, and God is usually a man for sure. And often God is surrounded by angels and harps and bunnies and the occasional unicorn and clouds and a big blue background when children draw God. It's an innocent invitation. Here, draw a picture of God, the rabbi says. And then he says it reminds him a little bit of this other image from the Sistine Chapel. Some of you have this image in your homes or in your offices where God on the right is pictured as a muscular, gray-headed man. And I can only show you the portion of the picture I can show you in church because I want to be your pastor next week. Rabbi Kushner says the image that children draw often looks a little bit like this one on the right, and he said it, he has that very image on a soap dish in his bathroom that he passes by every day. His conclusion is beautiful art, bad theology. Beautiful art, bad theology. Because to picture God is to begin to define God. And as soon as we begin to define God, we make some choices. And once we make those choices, then we eliminate the other choices. And we begin to now narrow down who God is and what God's capable of. Of course, it makes sense. We would imagine God to be of human form like ours because this is what we know. And God becomes human, and then pretty soon God has a color of skin, and God has a gender, and God has an age. God's not young. Goodness, who wants a young God? What does that God know? As soon as we make these choices, we begin picturing God in a particular way, and it's not too many steps before we begin picturing God with ideas and reasonings and emotions and choices that are like ours, and even preferences too. God has a favorite nation. God has a favorite religion. God has a favorite political party and a candidate. God has, well, good grief, God must be from the Pacific Northwest. Portland and Seattle are God's favorite cities. Vince Scully this weekend and Taco Tuesday this week, right? As soon as we begin to identify God, we begin to give God our preferences. The rabbi says that first of nine things he's learned over his lifetime is God is not a man who lives in the sky. God is not a man who lives in the sky. God's not any form of being that the rabbi can imagine. And the rabbi wants to say that clearly. I can't imagine the form or that which is God. I only know when the divine is moving, the Lord is compassionate and slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love. I only know that, the rabbi says. It's a human crisis we have to live without a physical God in our midst. It's not new. It's been going on since the beginning of our story here. And we fill in the gaps to soothe our own anxiety. Remember, this happened with Moses and the children of Israel when he's up on the mountain and he's gone too long and they become afraid. Moses was their embodiment of God. Moses represented the voice of the divine. Moses had all of the instructions. Moses knows the way out. And when Moses is gone for too long, they become anxious and say to Aaron, we've got to have another representation of, we have to have God. Where's God? So they take off all their jewelry. You know the story. They give it to Aaron and throw it in the fire and they craft a symbol of might and power and they put a golden bull, B-U-L-L, in their midst. And they decide to have a party and to bring offerings and sacrifices. And now they say of the bull, this is that which brought them out of the land of Egypt. This is their God. When Moses catches up to this, Aaron says to Moses something we've probably all said when we were 3 or 5 or 10. When Moses says to Aaron, what were you thinking? Aaron says, they gave me all their gold. I threw it in the fire and out jumped a bull. Bible records it that way. What were you thinking? Well, it just happened all by itself, Moses. Who knows how we got a bull in the middle of the camp? Who knows why we're partying around a big gold animal? Oh, it beats me. It just happened. When we're confused about who God is, we're confused about who we are and how we are to be in God's world. And then we are confused about how to image the divine. When we say, well, we're not tempted like the Israelites, I've never been tempted to make a bull or an idol or some fixture in my home. I've never been tempted to craft it or to even buy it raised Protestant. I've never been tempted to secure God down somehow and put God in my home or in here in our sanctuary. I don't have that temptation. We would never do that. We have to remember that what happened to Israel and all the generations that followed was simply just removing the second commandment from its context. And it could happen to any of us. The second commandment that found its place in the list of rules for how life would be best lived in relationship with God, the second commandment, don't make any idols, don't bow down to anything, it got dislodged from its context of the gracious God that brought them out of Egypt. And when that commandment got dislodged from its context, here's what happened. The people fell away from their story with God. It becomes a standalone teaching. The most literal reading of the commandment emerged. See if any of this sounds familiar, friends, to more modern-day problems. The commandment's dislodged from its original context. The most literal reading emerges. Don't create any image of anything, whether it's divine or mundane. By Deuteronomy 4, they're already talking about this. And then the conversation turns to definitions. Well, what's a graven image? Well, what's an image? Well, what's a molten image? Well, what's an idol? Well, what's an icon? And the Christian church, when it grew up by the second century, these are the questions they're now preoccupied with. Well, let's define what all of these words mean. So by the second century, now this is what they're arguing about. And when churches began to be built, these are the questions they have to ask. Can we have pictures? Can we have statues? Can we have carvings? Can there be any religious figures? When they were no longer meeting in houses and there are real buildings, we ask questions about what they ought to look like. And they're wrestling with these new houses of worship. Can there be pictures and images? Yes, but just not idols. And as time moves on, the leaders demand obedience to the leaders' interpretation of these definitions. As time moves on, pretty soon, there are to be no offerings. You can't receive the offerings from anyone who paints with color. This would be like saying the artists who work on campus can't contribute their offerings to the church. Can't receive offerings from those who work with bronze or gold. We can't take offerings from those who've venerated or stood around these idols or structures, paintings, symbols, structures, statues, pictures, all of these are an abomination. And this becomes a challenge. It's a challenge for new people they're attracting, because for the new people they're attracting, these things were beautiful. It's like a woman I studied with here many, many years ago. She came into the sanctuary and said, well, the windows are beautiful, but everything else is really ugly. She looked at the white walls everywhere and the wall space up here, and she said, where is your art? It's so ugly. Similar problem along the ages as new folks are attracted to this Christian faith. It doesn't translate as easy, and those who come who are illiterate, they can't read. Well, at least the pictures and the art helped them with some of their understanding. If they can't read, they can at least look at art and begin to make some assessments of what's happening in this space. And we get to the 8th century, and there's an entire movement that's established for the purpose of destroying all images of God, the iconoclast controversy. And now you've all just come through a 5-minute history lesson in Christian theology, and it matters. There's a whole movement now that their foundation and their purpose is to move around the world and to destroy anything that's profaning the image of God. And so they begin to erase over the face of Jesus or what looks like divinity, and they begin to chisel out parts of statues ruin things. The Jews, the early Christians, the Eastern Church, the Western Church, the Catholic Church, the Protestants, all of us took a position. When we can't do carved images, it's okay to do stained glass. And if we can't do gold overlay, it's okay to have a wooden communion table. And if we can't have a crucifix of Jesus in here, it's okay if we have the three angels from Revelation. All of us made a choice. All of us. The first religious symbol that I bought in my house was this small nativity set made out of pewter with Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus. And when my father saw this, we were newlyweds, I believe, no children in the house. It was a very calm and lovely life. My father came to visit. He picked up that little pewter baby Jesus and shook it at me and said, "What is this?" Baby Jesus had a halo around his head to represent his divinity. I said, I don't know. I guess it's a halo. And my father began to try and remove it because it's profaning Jesus. This is his tradition. It was my tradition. History, friends, history is always our teacher. History is always our teacher, and this morning we can look at how the church occupied itself by misunderstanding the second commandment and the self-revelation of God, who God says of himself, compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love, mercy, kindness, that beautiful cluster of words. Look what the church did to occupy itself. There were councils and riots and exiles and stonings. The church and God's people spent time over generations criticizing the graven images of others, pointing fingers. All the while, the Bible records that God's instructions in detail for the tabernacle include beautiful things, right? The tabernacle is supposed to be gorgeous. The tabernacle will have certain stones and silver and oil and spices and fragrances, and there are skilled craftspeople. Their crafts have been given to them by the divine. They'll make all of this beautiful. There'll be carven wooden images and carved stones and two cherubim on either side of the mercy seat with their wings in a particular fashion. And God says, "I'll meet you there. The only thing that's to be empty is the mercy seat." Because no one can imagine what occupies the mercy seat. Along with Rabbi Kushner, we cannot imagine it. The beginning of imagining it and defining it means we limit God. We cannot be certain about this, but we can have confidence in this God. The mercy seat is supposed to remain empty. All of this, friends, came from the request, the second commandment, Exodus 20, "You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven, above, on earth beneath, in the waters below. Don't bow down, don't worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." Adventist family, when we can't see the divine and when we've been wandering for a long time and when we thought we would be home in our lifetime, when we are worn down and exhausted from what's going on in our world, when this is our scenario, it can happen to us too. We can be confused about our God and confused about our role in God's world, and then confused about what it means to image God in our world. Psalm 145:8, "The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, rich in love. The universe runs on the mercy and loyal love of God," period. From beginning to end, this is what the Bible testifies. The universe will run on this love until this chapter of our story is over, and the next chapter will be fueled by this love. I'm getting ready in the next service at noon. We, the pastors and the church family, are getting ready to greet the new students who are coming to our campus. They've just had their first week of school. Any of you in here this morning, anyone had their first week of school and new to campus today? Charmaine, sophomore. How was school this week? Yeah, I know. Classes are starting for you. That's good. In the next service, we'll welcome many, many students, and I'm preparing to make an appeal to them to unpack here at this notion of God, a God who is gracious and compassionate and slow to anger, unpack here on a community that believes the world runs on mercy and loyal love. Whatever they've been taught, however they were raised, we invite them to unpack here and put down their roots, make a commitment, think about what Adventist Christianity has to offer, take the next steps. This is the appeal when we come to church at noon today. Be here with us. Don't just take classes. Unpack and be here. So you'll see things, for example, where you're sitting. There's something called a little church at noon worship journal where you're sitting. This came out of a focus group. These are blank pages. The idea is that during worship, you can do any of the things or other that you see here. Draw, doodle, write, reflect. Share your thoughts, draw your pictures, and then put it back in the pew rack. You don't take it home. You just put it back where you were sitting. And the next week, pick up a journal wherever you're sitting and do the same thing, and it becomes a community sharing of what we were thinking about while we're worshiping, what we're working on. It doesn't matter if we're thinking of lunch or we're thinking about the second commandment. It's an idea that came out of a focus group for church at noon, but church at 9:30, you're welcome to touch the journals and do the same. Isn't it an interesting idea? Share your thoughts and put them right back, and then we begin to see together what's the community thinking about and working on. We'll invite them after church at noon to go to the steps, the front steps of the church. You're invited as well today, too. When we think about a universe, a world, a riverside, the 92505 that runs on the loving mercy of God, then we want to know how to participate. So every week there'll be an appeal to go to the steps. There'll be tables on the front steps and something you could do. Today you can sign up to purchase sheets, bedding, linen. Not expensive, cheap. Go to Target, just fresh in a new package. And bring it to the church office. From here it'll go over to the county social work department, and that bedding will be put to use in all varieties of ways. Many of them will be for families that have been involved in CPS and have had to move and relocate, and they need to make beds for children and families and or put families back together again. That's one of the commitments today on the steps. The other is to sign up for the street cleaning on Pierce Street, because it's a church commitment to keep Pierce Street beautiful. We'll also invite the students after church today. If you were going to eat out anyway, go down to the Spaghetti Factory. We reserved the back room. Come and go as your own. You're invited to church. Come and go at your own. Let's eat together a little more often. Let's be together a little more often. Let's experience this love and mercy that runs the universe. You see, we're getting ready to make this appeal to the students at noon today. Consider Adventist Christianity. This is one of the most mobile generations in one of the most mobile nations, a generation that lives from chats to snaps to instant everything. We want them to unpack and be here. And it is not the easiest week in the Adventist church to make such an appeal. It appears we are preparing for a crisis at headquarters. Documents circulating, announcing intentions to take over unions. There's a governance authority battle swirling. It is the next chapter of a very wearisome tale. If you haven't heard this news, I'm sorry that I'm bringing it up this morning, and then I'm not. Even if it comes this time around that nothing happens next week, the damage is being done. Even if next week happens and there are no changes to the future of our territory, the Pacific Union, when we label people as rebellious because they're responding to the Spirit, the damage is being done. Even if nothing happens in the East Coast this week, when the word satanic is applied to outcomes and to people who have bathed themselves in prayer, the study of God's word, respect for the whole, surrender to the Spirit, damage has been done. when ecclesial power is grabbed rather than dispersed to the ground level where communities live and breathe and take their life, damage is being done. It appears a crisis is coming this week. Remember that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. A crisis sends us back to our Bibles. When we are confused about God, and that's my opinion of what's happening, this is theological. When we are confused about God, we are confused about ourselves, our part in God's story, and how we image God in our world. Never anywhere does the Bible say God's anger lasts forever, God goes after and controls wayward children. God can be disappointed, angry for a little while, but what lasts forever? Loving kindness and mercy. It's the prevailing way God moves around in God's story. So when the next generation gathers at church at noon, I'm going to tell them that here at La Sierra, we are a church that we're not known for our boundaries, we're known for God's generosity. We're not a church of Genesis chapter 3. We're a church of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. We'll tell the students this afternoon that this is the church that runs on the gracious, loving mercy of God. And we'll be humble about what this means. When the students come today, we'll invite them to do what we want to do every week when we gather. Be about the mercy of God. A few months ago, I read to you a letter from an inmate. His name was George. Some of you were here. It was late spring. Several of you took the address home. George was asking for anyone from the Adventist Church to write to him. He's been in jail for a while. Samira, you're one of the people that took the letter and wrote to George. I want to read you some of what's come back from George Hernandez. "Let me thank you," he says to one person who wrote him, "for having the courage to contact me. And let me thank God for the blessing of giving you this courage. I'm originally from Orange County." He tells a little bit of his story. "It is so good to hear from someone at your church. I've heard about the La Sierra University Church. I've heard about it while I've been here in jail." Isn't that beautiful? He'd been attending Protestant services. Someone invited him to go to the Adventist services. Then he goes on to talk about his family, and he says that he hopes when he gets out that God has a bright future for him. He believes God wants him to come to our community, and he'd like to go back to school and study, and he's glad to know we're part of a campus community. In another of the letters that he wrote back to Sam, he said, "Another inmate told me about your church. They spoke very highly of your church. He mentioned you're connected to the college. This is awesome. My major was business administration and management. I'm currently taking some classes, but I'd like to finish my degree. Maybe I can finish it at your university." And when George gets out, I hope he looks us up. He says, out of all the letters he's written, you are the first congregation with the courage to write to him. He keeps writing, you keep writing, he keeps writing. One day, we will be the congregation that will sit still while he sits with us in this church. Because the universe runs on the mercy and the loyal love of God. When it is offered to us, this is what God asks us to offer the world. Some weeks I don't think I have enough to say. This week is not one of them. Thanks be to God.